This is Irish Stephen Bear from Deep Space Nine, and you are listening to The Shuttle Pod. You lucky sons of bitches.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another edition of the Shuttle Pod podcast. I am your co-host, Kayla Iacovino, and I am joined, as always, by the rest of the Shuttle Pod crew. I'm here with Matt Wright.
Hey, everybody.
Jared Whitley.
Hello, friends.
And Brian Drew.
Hello, everybody.
The Shuttle Pod podcast is brought to you by the humans at Bye Bye Robot, purveyors of fine art from the future. Bye Bye Robot sells officially licensed Star Trek art made by multiple artists in many different styles at prices starting around $25. Go to byebyerobot.com to learn more.
That sounds like a great idea, Kayla. We should all hurry and check out that amazing art.
We should. Actually, I really do love the stuff that they
sell. They do actually have some really good stuff. It's true.
I've bought quite a few of their things over the years.
Oh, cool.
I have some hanging on my wall right now that I'm looking at while we're recording this.
Neat.
But today, so everyone can go to byebyerobot.com. Very generous sponsors of the Shuttle Pod podcast, the first and only ever sponsors. So we love them, and you should definitely check them out. But today, we are here to talk about Shuttle Pod episode number 42.
So Kayla, I think we talked about this a little bit last time, but episode 42, this is basically our Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy episode, right? Because, of course, number 42 is the answer to life, the universe, and everything. And there's a moment in the Star Trek 2009, which in my mind has always been a reference to Hitchhiker's Guide, where when Scotty and Kirk get beamed up to the Enterprise and like Spock is ordering Scotty to tell him what he knows or he'll court-martial him. And Scotty just keeps saying, "Can I get a towel, please?" Right? And he just keeps asking for a towel. I've always said, you know, they made all these towel references as reference to Douglas Adams. Because, of course, he says one of the famous lines from his book is that towels are the most useful items in the universe. I could be wrong, but that's always been what I thought.
It's a nice bit of headcanon either way.
Thank
it's
you.
Totally possible,
yeah,
too.
Totally.
Yeah, it's totally possible. So that's awesome.
So for this 42nd episode of the Shuttle Pod podcast, we started looking forward to what's coming up in Star Trek. And of course, in just a couple of weeks, we're going to be treated to the premiere episode of Star Trek Discovery, which airs on September 24th. And speaking of Discovery, I think it's germane to announce here for the first time on podcast waves that while Discovery is on the air, the Shuttle Pod will be dedicated to covering each episode of Star Trek Discovery as it airs. So this episode number 42 is the last traditional episode of the Shuttle Pod until Discovery goes on hiatus in November. But that said, this episode is germane to talking about Discovery because while we get treated to the pilot episode of Star Trek Discovery in a couple of weeks, we thought we'd go back and take a look at the original series pilot episodes, of which there were actually two. I'm speaking, of course, about the original first pilot, The Cage, and then the second pilot, Where No Man Has Gone Before. And for both of those things, we're going to be looking at, number one, how well does each pilot set up the premise for the series, for the original series? Number two, how well does each pilot function as a story on its own? And then finally, how do each of the pilots compare to each other in the world of the original series? So let's start out talking about The Cage, which was the first pilot, the quote-unquote failed pilot for the original series. But before we start getting into it, into the nitty-gritty, what actually happened in the episode The Cage? Brian?
Okay, here we go. This is a recap courtesy of our colleagues over at Memory Alpha. While investigating a distress call from Talos IV, Captain Christopher Pike of the Starship Enterprise is captured and tested by beings who can project powerfully realistic illusions.
Good, have it. Good recap, Ray.
Why, thank you.
I like your fake radio voice, radio announcer voice.
It's great.
I figured we'd add a little levity to the proceedings, you know?
Good, good, good. And levity was something that was in short supply on the first mission of the USS Enterprise.
Indeed it was, the Jerry thing, Whitley.
The thing that's always been so weird to me about that is the funny one in the cage is Spock.
Ah, good point.
Yeah.
Everyone else is pretty joyless.
Yeah, it's a very typical Gene Roddenberry kind of humorless affair.
The touch point of that humorlessness would be Captain Pike, our hero, who he'd only appear. I mean, in the original series, actual original series, he only appears just briefly when they bring this back for the menagerie. But the character had quite an impact. He was in two of the JJ verse movies, and he's referenced a couple times throughout the rest of the series. I remember particularly there's one episode of Deep Space Nine where Captain Sisko is awarded the Christopher Pike Medal of Valor. So,
right.
So in universe, he's a pretty big deal, even though we don't get to see much of him. But
they reference him. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
No, and they also wanted to say they referenced him in Mirror Mirror too.
Oh, that's right, because he killed him.
Mentioning that Kirk succeeded him by assassinating him.
That's right.
That's right.
I forgot that. Yeah. And we could go to his Memory Alpha page and see all the other references. But what do we think of Captain Pike as a character and Jeffrey Hunter as an actor as our first captain?
I thought he was super hunky.
Ooh. Super hunky.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest,
he's a handsome man.
Like, it's, yeah, he's a really handsome guy. Like, he was a tough act to follow for William Shatner. That's all I'll say.
He's got the brooding thing down, too. You know,
he can dark and crap handsome, out of a scene.
Yeah. He is tall, dark, and handsome. Yeah.
Yes.
And his eyes are ridiculous.
It's true. Yeah. He's got dreamy eyes. I'll say that. It's true.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a line on an episode of 30 Rock where Jack Donaghy says he has, of describing himself, says he has the piercing blue eyes of an ice dragon. And that kind of describes
awesome.
Jeffrey Hunter to a T.
Yeah. It does.
Yeah. And one of the, I think his eyes were so. One of his selling points as an actor was his eyes, and he was cast as Jesus Christ only 3 or 4 years before this in a movie called The King of Kings.
Yeah, I'm looking at the pictures right now.
Yeah, I mean, and I think a lot of that had to do with the fact that he had that unbelievably intense, like, look that he could give with those eyes of his.
Yeah. Yeah, like that, particularly that scene where he's there with Dr. Boyce. And he brings him some booze, and he says, "Men will tell things their bartender, then love each other, doctor." He's commanding that scene with the power of his eyes alone.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, you can see a lot of wear and tear in it too. He's very tired. He's very worn out.
Yeah,
but at the same time, there's that intensity.
Yeah, you kind of get the impression that Christopher Pike does not particularly enjoy the rigors of command.
No,
like he views it as a kind of a very heavy burden.
And I think that's one of those little strike one about it being a pilot is here's this guy who's tired of it. He feels a burden. That's not exactly the leading hero you'd expect of a 60s right. TV show.
Maybe that is a product of the time as you're suggesting that, but I kind of really liked, especially on this rewatch of The Cage, it's been a little while for me since I'd watched it. I really liked this idea that Pike was like a flawed hero.
And I think so do we. I think all of us really.
Yeah,
like
well,
that,
I also like, I would argue the fact that, and maybe this isn't an argument at all, that, Pike was maybe not overall in general tired of command, but I think I feel like he was in a rut, you know? Like, he's, like, had a rough go of it. He was stressed out. And, like, we've all been there. We've questioned, like, what am I doing with my life? Like, you know, because he's like, I'm going to go, like, be a slave trader on Orion or whatever.
Mm-hmm. He just had that terrible mission. He just had that terrible mission to Rigel 7 where he lost people.
Yeah, where some men died.
Right. And a lot of people were hurt.
Yeah, a lot of people were hurt. It's not a good day for him, you know?
But by the end of it, you know, the character actually has a big arc. In this show, in The Cage, you know, Pike comes or he starts out as being someone who's like practically ready to quit his job. And by the end of it, although I think this could have been driven home a little bit more strongly, but what they seem to be going for was that by the end of it, he's made this full 180 and is like, oh, now I understand, like, you know, you know, I've been reminded of why I'm here and why I do this kind of thing.
And you know what? This had never occurred to me until you hung a lantern on it, Kayla. But that's exactly what happens with Benjamin Sisko in Emissary. He's ready to leave Starfleet because, you know, in his case, it's because he's lost his wife. And then he has this contact with these super intelligent aliens and comes around and decides, no, this is where I belong.
Yep, you're right. It's just like the cage.
Very much the same. Yeah.
So can I interject something? You talk about being a product of the time. Something that has occurred to me in the last few weeks as we've gotten ready for Discovery is we've talked a little bit before of, is Starfleet a military organization? You know, and when Star Trek first aired, it was a time when the draft like existed. Like if you were a young man when you turned 18,
very much boom, so in fact
the government drafted you, right? And that hasn't been the case since the early 70s, right, when Nixon ended the draft during the Vietnam War. But at the time that this was on the air, if you were a man, you had probably served in the military in some capacity, and you had probably served in World War II, right? And you probably carried some scars. And so this is there's a context to this that we don't understand, right? I mean, like, when I turned 18, I had to register with Selective Service, but at no point in my brain did I ever think, yes, the government is going to draft me. But that was order of the business, order of the day in the 1960s. Oh,
yeah. Wow, that's crazy. I'd never thought about that.
When he's kind of world-weary, or space-weary, I guess as it is, he's giving voice to a concern that I think a lot of men had. Because even though World War II had been 20 years earlier, the Korean War was still relatively fresh, and then Vietnam was underway at this point.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's a good segue into thinking about one of our first touch points that we're going to hit on, which is how well does the pilot set up the premise for the original series? So given this idea of this character who's kind of worn out but then sees the light, in terms of, you know, why he's in Starfleet, what he wants to do, and also in terms of like, what is Starfleet? Is it militaristic? Is it about exploration? You know, how do you guys feel like after watching The Cage, if you'd never seen another episode of Star Trek before, do you think it sets up in your mind what the series ended up being?
I think it actually sets up the premise better than Where No Man Has Gone Before does, in terms of being more intellectual and less actiony.
But that was by design.
Oh, sure, of course.
We could talk about Where No Man Has Gone Before and why it's so tonally different when we get to it, but yeah, that was very intentional.
Yeah, but I think The Cage sets up the premise of the series very well.
I agree. It is Star Trek. It's not completely polished and finished Star Trek, but at its core, it is telling a very Star Trek story with, you know, with a recognizable Star Trek situation. So I think it totally sells the show. Mm-hmm.
It has a very human kind of message, especially with when you look at the sort of the view of the Talosians, right? They distinctly say they don't know how to work the machinery anymore because they've gotten too absorbed in their sort of higher, you know, trappings of their higher brain function, of their illusions, right? And so that's a very Gene thing to say. Well, no, but look, humans are the right balance of this sort of thing, right? Humans can do both. You know, humans can be this positive force, and they're, you know, but they won't get lost, right? They won't get lost in their ingenuity. They won't get lost in their technology. But these guys did at some point.
Matt, I think that's a really good point, and something I was sort of going to bring up, but you said it better than I could have. But just to sort of follow up on that, it's this whole theme of, you know, exploring the human condition. What does it mean to be human? And sort of in an optimistic viewpoint, which is something that's super Trek, right? Like, what makes us great as a species? And yeah, we have a lot of flaws, but you know, what if there's this future where we're able to grow our positive qualities into something amazing?
Mm-hmm.
You know, then, you know, what are those positive qualities that we can nurture and grow that really define who we are as humans?
Mm-hmm. So that potential is sort of there, lying in wait in the cage. A lot of it's sort of not spelled out, which is probably for the better. I mean, we don't need things handed to us on a platter, right? But
I completely agree.
But as we know, the network kind of wanted things more handed to them on a platter, right? there's a piece of that
Yeah. You know, and in terms of talking about setting up the premise of the series, I've mentioned several times, I've always seen a big connection between the original Twilight Zone and the 1960s Star Trek. And this always feels more like an episode of Twilight Zone to me, kind of, than an episode of Star Trek.
Oh, definitely. As a big fan of both, I totally agree with you. And that's probably one of the reasons why I've always sort of been attracted to the Cage, like even as a kid, and because there's a lot of odd stuff, especially as a little kid. Like there's a lot of weird stuff that goes on with very weird looking aliens, but it's all really interesting, right? Because there's this whole, well, what if they could give you what you want, but then you know it's an illusion? Like, are you okay with that? And of course, we know Pike is not okay with this. Like, but you could so easily see someone being like, okay. I've had his life was really rough right then. You know, he lost those crew members in Rigel 7, et cetera, et cetera. He was thinking about giving up, you know, out of the fleet, right? Out of the service. You could totally see a different person going, okay, I can be whatever I want. I'm good being breeding stock, you know? Like a certain person might be like, no, I'm fine being breeding stock if this is what it means. It means I get to live out whatever I'd like.
Mm-hmm.
But that is not Pike. And in theory, I don't think that's where the human race is supposed to be, right? That doesn't seem very Roddenberry to say anyone anyone in Starfleet would be interested in that, right? They just wouldn't.
And, you know, I was thinking of this as I was watching the episode, and obviously I knew what was going to happen, but at the same time I was thinking, like, well, if this was actually the pilot that they used and this aired, and it was part of, it's still canon, but if it was more a part of what eventually became the show, they could have ended the original series in the worst way ever, which would be the last episode of the original series would be, just kidding, Captain Pike never left Talos 4.
It was all a dream.
Awful.
Yeah.
Wouldn't it be awful?
Wouldn't it be the worst thing ever?
That would just be awful. Beautiful. So glad they didn't do that.
But they actually don't ever, like, you know, that thought was crossing my mind the entire time, like, when are they going to be sure that it's not a trick anymore?
Yeah, that's actually raises a good point, which is they bring that up and then kind of just move on. Like Spock brings up, he goes, oh, they could make us think we're pressing buttons, you know, that we don't think we're pressing. And it's like, yeah. So at what point do you really truly know you're actually warping away? Like you've gotten away from them.
Right.
And you're done, you know? So, yeah, good point.
They still could do that, technically. Since the Cage is canon, the last episode of Discovery could be like, just kidding.
Oh, no.
It'll be like Enterprise. Like the last episode of Enterprise.
Yeah, it's all Hollywood
fantasy.
For the
whole series.
I think it's more likely that they just have a younger actor playing Captain Pike who appears on the series at some point.
Yes, that they're going to have a hard time. They're going to have a hard time resisting that for sure.
Yeah.
So I was just going to say, I think we should talk about Spock in this episode because he's quite a bit different than the Spock we come to know.
In the Cage, he's just kind of this weird looking dude who yells a lot.
Yeah. And he's got a very clear kind of sarcastic edge to him.
Yeah.
And his eyebrows are all wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah, the eyebrows are a little
smiles
more satanic
when they're on the planet surface.
When they see the flowers. My favorite line from Leonard Nimoy in this is when the number one and the comely young ensign get beamed away and he yells out, "The women!"
Yep.
The women!
Yeah.
It's so ridiculous. Oh my gosh. There's a product of its era too. Like,
okay,
really?
But having said that, the Cage is way less... I mean, the sexism in Cage is tiny, right? I mean, the fact that the ladies wear pants, the fact that number one, that the woman is the first officer, and then you can, we can talk about this. Well, I'll just talk about it now. In Where No Man Has Gone Before, they're like sexually harassing Elizabeth Daner.
They are.
Like,
absolutely.
Calling her a walking refrigeration unit or whatever.
Yes. Yes.
So I think
in Mitchell does apologize for that, though.
Okay, yeah.
So you guys,
but Captain Pike never
like
had to apologize.
Yeah.
There is the flip side to all of this really nice progressive stuff on board, which is that Vina is paraded around in a little tiny dress as breeding stock, though. Don't forget.
Yeah, but that was the Talosians doing that.
Sure, but again, there you go.
Yeah. I know, but at least they sort of work.
But if you're trying to lure somebody that you need to breed, perpetuate your species, you're going to dress them up in as something as alluring and as sexually exciting as possible.
Oh, I agree. Yeah. I agree. So it's not terrible. Just and thinking about it.
I would like I'm glad, Jared, that you brought up the like the sexism or lack of sexism in the cage compared to other episodes of TOS, especially because I think other people might disagree with me on what this scene was about, but I felt like in one of the first scenes where they have Captain Pike talking to Number One on the bridge, they're like hanging a lantern on the fact that sexism exists and it exists in 1966 and it sucks. And on the one hand, they're doing a sort of non-Trek thing in that they're not saying like, oh yes, we've moved past sexism and despair and hunger. Instead, they're saying, no, sexism is still around. They have Captain Pike. What does he say? He says something about...
I can't get used to having a woman
on the
bridge.
That's right. Yeah, because he runs into the yeoman and he says, I can't get used to having a woman on the bridge. And then, you know, Number One says something. I think he's like, oh, you're different, of course. And then she like looks kind of grumpy about it. But
yeah,
it's
she
like,
gives him a look.
Yeah, but they purposely cut to her like giving him a look like that wasn't
sure.
cool.
Sure.
And I
yeah,
think that's
yeah, yeah.
what makes it like, I think the writers were doing that on purpose. I don't think the writers were being sexist. I think the writers were like, look how much sexism sucks.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think the cage, I think, can get an A+ on this.
Yeah, I think so too. I was like, that's pretty woke of him for 1966.
And everyone
wears technically
pants.
65, because it came out the year
you're right.
before.
Yeah,
64.
64.
It was shot in 64. Wow. Yeah. It was shot in 64.
Yeah. But that's okay. The point is that era.
No, we have to get it right because people will
call
us out
on
that.
Oh, darn
it. Exactly. It was episode 58.
But funny enough, according to Gene, now Gene wrote that episode. The cage is a complete Roddenberry
thing.
That's
a very Gene thing, yeah.
The whole thing was very Gene. But according to Gene, the people who objected to a woman being on the bridge in test screenings were women.
Yeah, that's right.
I believe every second of that.
Mm-hmm. And he said the reaction was, who does she think she is? It was that kind of a thing, according to Gene. Now, who the hell knows? I mean, Gene told a lot of tall tales, so who the hell knows? Yeah. But that's what he claimed.
I have zero, as a woman, I have zero trouble believing that. Because we are our worst enemies.
Yeah. So, I thought that was interesting.
That is interesting.
I like the character, you know? And like I said, she's pretty progressive for that era. And, you know, this also drives home something else about the original series, which I do think does get lost. Now, of course, there was sexism in the show. The show's 50 years old. You're going to see a lot of things that obviously you wouldn't see now. But it does drive home how progressive the original Star Trek series was.
Yeah.
It may look dated now, but they tried to do stuff that nobody else was trying to do. And Number One's a really good example of that.
Yeah, and that's more than can be said for a lot of later iterations of Star Trek. Like I think if you could come up with a mathematical quotient for how progressive a series was for its time, I think TOS might win.
Yeah, I think it's TOS and Voyager are probably the peaks, and I think Enterprise is a really low point as an example. So yeah,
that might be a fun discussion to have at some point.
That's a different discussion.
I'll come up with a mathematical formula. Don't worry, it'll be
called the
Keynes-Zerillo
ratio. Iacovino equation.
Iacovino quotient, yeah.
So do we want to say any last things about the cage before we move on then?
The last thing I want to say just about what do we think about Dr. Boyce?
Oh yeah, I like him.
Yeah, I mean, he's a prototype of McCoy. I mean, the whole relationship with him and Pike is very Kirk McCoy.
Yeah.
And also
that could have easily been Leonard McCoy walking into those quarters, giving him a drink.
They could just swap out the actors and the dialogue would be unchanged.
I hate the fact that it's not DeForest Kelly though.
Ah.
Oh, sure. Mm.
Nothing against the guy who plays Dr. Boyce, but like D. Kelly
John
is
Hoyt.
So awesome.
Yeah, John Hoyton is in everything too. He's everywhere.
Yeah.
That guy does all kinds of stuff.
Well, the other thing
was in a lot of features. He was in a lot of TV shows
He's in the Twilight Zone.
He's in my favorite episode of the Twilight Zone. So I love seeing him.
I was going to say,
what's your favorite episode?
Thanks to ask. The name of the episode is "Since Will the Real Martian Please Stand Up?"
Yes, fantastic episode.
These six people get trapped in a diner in a snowstorm, and they realize, oh wait, there should only be five of us.
Yeah.
Right.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Love that one.
Cool. Yep. Before we do move on officially from the cage, though, I think we should touch on how the episode functions as a storyline in a vacuum. So we've sort of talked about how it sets up the series, but what about just like the story, the script of the cage as its own open and shut story?
So I think it's very standalone, actually. You could tell that they were making this as a one-off in case it didn't get picked up. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And it does. It's since it's actually longer than 60 minutes, like, or even, you know, 54 or so, whenever it was for a real network thing. This is more like, I think, 86 minutes long when they made it. And so it totally stands alone. It's almost like a little TV movie of the week. That wasn't a thing so much back then, but you could see it being like a TV movie of the week almost. And I think that's kind of cool, right, that they wrote it that way.
Yeah, and that TV movie of the week thing is probably what would have happened to it had Star Trek not actually sold.
Oh, totally. Yeah,
that would have been run, or maybe it would have had like a low level theatrical engagement, like B level movie kind of thing, so they could try to make some money off of it. That's probably what would have happened to it.
So, just thinking, if there are infinite numbers of alternate universes, you know, where every possible scenario can occur, there is one alternate universe where the cage never turned into Star Trek. Star Trek never existed. The cage was its own, you know, hour and a half long made for TV movie in 1965. And the four of us are still having a podcast about it.
Ooh. Yeah.
So then that's some real esoteric podcasting then, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So props to Other Universe Us for talking about a 50-year-old hour and a half made for TV movie. But I digress.
That's awesome.
So I think we can safely introduce... We don't have to stop talking about the cage now by any means, but I think we can safely introduce Where No Man Has Gone Before. What do you guys think?
Let's do it.
Sure.
Brian, would you do the honors, please?
Yeah.
Okay. Once again, courtesy of our friends at Memory Alpha. An encounter at the limits of our galaxy begins to change Lieutenant Commander Gary Mitchell and threatens the future of the Enterprise and the human race itself.
Dun, dun.
So there you go.
The human race itself.
Yeah, yeah.
Cue the ominous horns.
Dun, 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 dun.
But you gotta end it on like a weird note. It's like,
dun, yeah, dun, dun, I needed to end dun, on a minor
dun,
key.
Dun, dun,
yeah.
Dun.
Yeah, there it is. There it is. You got it.
Yeah. It's totally true.
All right, so Where No Man Has Gone Before. Gary Mitchell, Silvery Eyes, Edge of the Universe, Edge of the Galaxy.
Yes. The Galactic Barrier.
Take us out of the galaxy. Time Warp Factor 1.
Yeah, they were still filling out the nomenclature of Star Trek.
Why were they? It's really obvious in the cage, to jump back for a second, when they talk about, oh, we've broken the time barrier now, is what they say.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Like, what does that mean? Huh?
Well, I think, I mean, they're just...
Time warp that is factor what 7. Warp,
yeah, time warp factor. That is what warp is, kind of, right? It was, some people say it's like Mach.
Well, sure. I mean, I guess. But
speed of light.
But the whole pseudoscience about it somehow also skips around the relativistic problems, you know? And it's like, I don't know, whatever. All right, you know?
Well, it actually kind of works if you're warping space itself, but that's something we can talk about on a different podcast.
That's a whole other podcast.
Yes, it is.
Indeed. So obviously this was the second pilot that actually sold the series. The NBC, I mean, I think a lot of people know this, but just to briefly recap, NBC liked The Cage. One of the executives, I believe, said that they felt like they had been in space after watching it, but they said it was quote unquote too cerebral. And they didn't think audiences would like it. And they also felt like Gene kind of pulled a fast one on them. Because Gene sold Star Trek as the quote-unquote wagon train to the stars.
Yep.
Suggesting a certain, obviously, an obvious Western element to the program.
Yep.
And nobody who watched The Cage was going to confuse it with a Western.
Right. I think this is where we get the Kirk era and why they would recast the captain. For that very reason.
Well, not necessarily. Jeffrey Hunter simply refused to return. That's the idea was to continue with Hunter.
Do we know why he refused?
Oh, really? I'd never heard that.
He wanted to go off and do features.
Yeah
he was getting a lot of.
Yeah, and his agent, or I think it might have been his wife, kept telling him, you know, you're this television's beneath you, science fiction's beneath you.
Oh yeah, that's right. I think it was his wife.
Wow.
Yes.
So,
oh, that worked out for him.
Yeah. Well. Yeah, Jeffrey Hunter unfortunately passed away young. And
had he died in 69, so he wouldn't have even really made it.
Oh,
like,
wow.
Seasons.
He would have died right after the series went off the air, basically.
Yeah, it's a real bummer. Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, yeah, he simply chose not to return, which is why Gene started canvassing Hollywood looking for a leading man.
Well, and I will say, I think it makes sense that they looked for a very different energy.
Yes.
To go with the wagon train Western, you know, leading hero thing.
Right. So anyway, that's why William Shatner was cast, because Jeffrey Hunter moved on.
As a leading man, I like William Shatner much, much better. And granted, I'm more familiar with him, but I also think the fact that the character is more jovial and dynamic is more fun to watch.
Yeah. Shatner is a more charismatic performer.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Leonard Nimoy thinks that had Shatner not come to the show, number one, would not have worked. And number two, he doesn't feel like he would have had anything to play as Spock.
Yeah.
Because he has said, more than once is that Jeffrey Hunter tended to be an internalized performer. Like, he was not an extrovert in his performances. Like, he was, you could see it. He's very stoic. And when he plays Pike, he's not very, you know, I guess, gregarious and outgoing. The character, the portrayal, his energy is not high, I guess would be the best way to put it. And because Spock had to be reserved as well, they were both going to be underplaying everything, basically. So Leonard felt like had Pike stayed, Leonard didn't really have any place to play Spock. Like, and he said when Shatner came in and had all this incredible energy, it allowed Leonard to dial everything way back. And that's how you got that great contrast between Kirk and Spock.
So who was it? I mean, maybe it was a group effort, I guess. But who was it that really turned Spock into what we know him as? Because I think, and going back to sort of talking about how well each of these pilots set up the premise of the series, we can talk about how well each set up the characters as well. We kind of talked about that in The Cage, how Spock is a totally different character. And he's you know, Where No Man Has Gone Before Spock has a lot in common with The Cage Spock.
But he's becoming more of the Spock we know.
Sure.
Yes.
Now.
There's still, I feel like there's a spectrum of, like...
Because they officially call him out for, like, not having emotions and Where No Man Has Gone
Before. Yeah, in the opening scene when they're playing 3D chess, he says he'd be irritated with him. And he says, irritated. Ah, yes, one of your Earth emotions. And it's one of those great things where Leonard is being sarcastic in a non-sarcastic way.
Well, in early Spock, even into the series, early Spock actually is sarcastic. They didn't quite write that out of him right away.
As for my anatomy being different than yours, I am delighted.
I am delighted. Yeah. It took about a good 6 or 7, 8 episodes maybe during the series for the writing staff and Leonard to get a handle on Spock.
Yeah. Okay.
But as you were saying, I think it goes back to, I think it starts here and I think it starts now as a balancing act between two actors, right? Him being able to sort of play off of Shatner more, or actually I guess play might be the wrong word, but dial it down because Shatner is more energetic, and that's the sort of start of the Spock as we know it.
And speaking of, you know, how Kayla was just saying how Spock kind of developed over time, this has been said elsewhere, but it bears mentioning here too.
Yeah.
William Shatner is playing the Kirk we all know and love immediately.
Yes.
Like, there is, like, no learning curve. That is the same Kirk you see the last time you see him in Generations. Like, that is the same guy.
Yeah.
Kirk Shatner found him immediately.
Yes, absolutely.
It's very impressive when you think about it.
Yeah.
It's actually pretty impressive.
Yeah. Good point. Because, I mean, you can't say the same about really anybody else.
No, just Kirk. He had him down. He figured out who he was and went with that approach and never wavered from it.
And maybe since he's a leading man, maybe that has a lot to do with how this second pilot then set up the rest of the series and how it was successful at that in certain ways.
Yes.
I think him getting his shirt torn was certainly a good thing. You know?
That's a good
that
setup.
That definitely became a thing, right? That he was more of an action hero. Because we see Pike, but Pike's kind of a reluctant action hero, right? Like, yeah, he had to go stab the giant beast dude on Rigel 7. Yeah, but he hated doing it, right?
Some barbarian.
He took no joy in it. I mean, not that you should really take joy in killing someone, but you know what I mean. He was very over it, right? He couldn't believe that he had to put up with this kind of shit, basically. And then there's, you know, and then there's Kirk, who's just like going at, you know,
Kirk
going
at things with gusto. Come at me, bro.
Yeah, exactly. And even when it is his bro, Gary Mitchell, you know?
Yeah, and he doesn't back down even in the face of, you know, pseudo gods. He calls them into action.
Which is also a very good Roddenberry thing, which is like, no, these aren't gods, you know. They're human and we can take them down a peg if we
And Kirk basically talks himself out of that situation as well. Because he has no real physical power over them. I mean, I guess in the end
he crushes
Gary Mitchell with rocks, which somehow is enough. But
because Gary's weak,
he gets help from Elizabeth because she has powers too.
But he kind of talks her into that, right?
Yes, he does.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Okay.
So it's almost like the way with, you know, famously with Nomad or these other Kirk, like, you know, talking his way out of a situation like that. I think that basically is what happened here.
Kirk sweet talks the lady almost. It's not quite that trope, but we're starting to see it.
Right.
You know? Yeah.
No, I think it's just one of those. I actually think what he's doing there is the beginning of the pontificating that we would see later. Like the speeches about morality and everything else that Gene would put in his mouth.
Very, true.
I think that's what you start seeing there.
True.
Absolute power corrupting absolutely, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But speaking of that fight between Kirk and Gary Mitchell, talking about comparing between the two pilots, because NBC was so, you know, unhappy with the fact that there wasn't enough action in the original pilot, that Gene basically put that fist fight in at the end of When No Man Has Gone Before because he felt like he had to.
Yeah, just to please people.
Oh, yeah.
Because it is kind of stupid, that fight.
It is. And you can see it's lifted straight out of like a generic Western in that sense. Of like, you've got to go have a fist fight somewhere, right? Like,
right. Okay. And Gene didn't want to do it, but he felt like he had to. And it worked because it sold the series.
Yeah.
Right.
And he did have to do that.
Yes.
He did.
He did. Should we, let's back it up for a second and let's talk about Gary Mitchell and who he is, because we haven't really talked about him. Because he's an interesting character that, of course, only exists for this one pilot. But I think he's kind of interesting because in theory, he fleshes out Kirk's back right away. He fleshes out somebody's backstory. Right?
Good point. Like
in the cage, we have no backstory. Pike doesn't have much of a backstory. We just know he's a burned out guy now. But with Kirk, I think one of the things that really helps make him a more three-dimensional person, perhaps, and more relatable, perhaps, because I think we've all said we also like Pike a lot, but is that, hey, we instantly know, like, this is basically his old college buddy. Effectively.
Yeah.
Right? Oh yeah.
And so this is cool. Like he got his first command as a very young, you know, the youngest captain in Starfleet. And what did he do? He wanted his bro, like, to give him a spot. And it's kind of cool, and it's kind of a fun thing that, like, here's Kirk and here's his best buddy. Of course he assigned his best buddy to work under him. And unlike the series, Mitchell is technically the second officer and Spock is simply the science officer. So it's a little bit different, at least initially. That's how, you know, the roles. So, and I, you know, Gary Mitchell's kind of a horn dog a little bit. He's totally the frat bro that of the series at the moment, but that's okay.
See, which if we're going to go back to our question, how well does this set up the series? The presence of Gary Mitchell, I think, is off because he takes up too much space that would need to be occupied by other characters. I mean, if he's being more of the ladies' man, then he's stepping on Kirk's toes. And if he's the best friend, then he's stepping on Spock's toes. So the character had to die, much as I hate to say
it. Yes, totally. He's definitely a dead character walking. Like, you can't keep him.
But you, like you said, though, Matt, he does flesh out Kirk's background a little bit. You find out that Kirk was a very intense
Kirk young was man actually a little bit of a nerd.
He was an overachiever.
Right. And it's intimated several times throughout the original series that Kirk was actually, when he was younger, was very intense and a bit nerdy.
Yep. Yeah.
And Gary Mitchell says, you know, you had to keep your eye out for Lieutenant Kirk in his class. You either think or sink.
That's right.
Yep, that's it. Think or sink.
And he was so serious that, you know, Gary, in order to loosen him up, he quote-unquote aimed a blonde lab technician at him.
Correct.
Yeah, which Brian, Kirk almost married. For
all we know, might be, yeah. could be, which could be, for all we know, Carol Marcus.
Yeah. Right, that's the hint, yeah, is maybe this is Carol Marcus, yeah.
So something I want to say, speaking of New Trek, Carol Marcus, is a segue. This is something that really bugs the crap out of me with the Kelvin verse, is that Kirk mm-hmm. is portrayed as this like Hellion frat boy type of character.
Yes.
It's like, no, yeah,
I dislike
that's,
that.
That's not how you become the youngest captain ever in a military organization. You excel by following the rules, doing what you're supposed to.
Yep.
Yes.
Yeah, until you earn enough respect to where you can start to make the tough call of needing to bend the rules.
Yeah, right, it's like there's this quote about jazz that says you need to learn the rules before you can break the rules.
Yeah.
Right. Oh, good quote. Yeah. I think it's interesting and kind of telling that we have an article coming up soon that Kayla did a lot of research for about where these characters are at the time of Discovery. And it's really telling that Kirk, you know, normal Prime Universe Kirk, is so serious and excelling in his work that he's a lieutenant while still technically finishing his 4 years. Mm-hmm. And that's really says something that he's essentially, you know, he got the work done and the impressed enough people that when he finishes his tenure in the Academy, he's already like up two ranks from where he would be.
Mm-hmm.
That's really impressive.
He's teaching classes at the Academy as well.
Right. And he's turning around and teaching underclassmen and stuff. So that's really cool.
A very, very driven man.
Right. It's something that, like Jared was saying, maybe missing from other versions of Kirk.
But, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. I thought they took the easy way out in the Kelvin timeline. I mean, to me, a character study is far more interesting when you go back and everybody obviously has this notion of Kirk being this Lothario and extremely confident man. Wouldn't it be interesting to look at him and what he was like, say, when he was 16 and unsure of himself and was kind of nerdy?
Right.
Yeah. And seeing that transformation.
Yeah. Cause you figure like, we know that he used to just be an Iowa farm boy. That's, you know, he could have grown up not incredibly, not incredibly socially aware, right? He could have grown up by himself, you know, like him and his brother out in a farm, for all we know. They kind of imply that, right? And so, hey, yeah, maybe him having really high marks and getting into the Academy is the first time he's really in a really big city, really big social situations. And it's, you know, it's just a different world for him initially.
See, this is also something I love about the Picard character is he's depicted as the opposite of this, whereas he was the more rambunctious guy in his youth and the more level-headed guy in his old age, and Kirk is the
reverse.
That's
right.
Totally. Yeah, I love it. What a great observation.
Thank you.
I mean, well, what did Picard say about himself? He was a fool, very much in need of seasoning.
Yeah. Good quote, Brian.
I really love to talk a bit more and hear what you guys think about just directly comparing these two pilots, The Cage and Where No Man Has Gone Before, all the while sort of considering that The Cage was originally rejected and Where No Man Has Gone Before was the thing that ended up actually selling the show.
There's no question that Where No Man Has Gone Before is more engaging in the sense that it's got more action and more humor. It's easier to compare the intellectual versus the non-intellectual stuff. But the fact that it starts with Kirk and Spock joking is important.
I think there's a lot of things like that Where No Man Has Gone Before has that The Cage doesn't, that are important and good and necessary. But I don't know, like, honestly, I kind of think The Cage is a better story. I think it's a more I think it's a more interesting science fiction story. I think it's more interesting to see our main character have such a large arc. I think it's interesting to have the beginning of the story of Captain Pike, who we would, in theory, keep following for several seasons, be him, you know, relearning why his job is so important to him, because that's sort of teaching the whole audience like why Starfleet is important and why exploration is important.
Sure.
All really good points. And I think what's funny is, I think what you just described, Kayla, is you could almost say is what we think a lot of the plotline for Burnham and Discovery is. Like, you know what I mean? She's this flawed yes. person. She's a bright person, but she's a little flawed. She's very intense. She's very interested in exploration. Like, it's kind of interesting. You can take these little bits and pieces and rearrange them, and I think you've got a lot of qualities for Discovery in that.
We know that Burnham has this quote-unquote fall from grace, which Pike had sort of just before the cage, and he's kind of reeling from that in the cage.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if they call it fall from grace for Pike.
No, Pike just got beat up, basically. But
yeah, they just came off a very rough mission where they...
But, you know, okay, but again, no, that's
there's
fair.
A, there's
that's
a
fair,
rough point. Fair. There's a rough point.
Yeah, maybe I'm making too direct of a correlation, though. That's a good point.
Yeah. Come on, Kayla. They don't throw people in jail for having feelings. Otherwise, we'd all have to turn ourselves in.
See, when we don't have lines like that in either pilot, because McCoy's missing.
Yeah, exactly.
That wasn't McCoy.
Oh, wait, was that McCoy?
Yep.
That was Chekhov.
Well, no, McCoy sets it up and then Chekhov spikes it.
Oh, my bad. Well, there you go. I knew it was set up by McCoy somewhere. That's a very McCoy-like
The Undiscovered moment. Country.
Yeah.
Yes. Sorry. Clearly, I need to rewatch Undiscovered Country. It's been a while.
Yeah. We got a little off the rails there. So, okay. It seemed appropriate. Any other comparisons between the two that we want to make?
It's just that I think Where No Man feels more like what Star Trek would become after than The Cage did.
Yes, for sure.
From an aesthetic standpoint, obviously the props in Where No Man are a little more fully realized. Like, the communicator in The Cage is a joke. Like, when Pike opens his communicator, that close-up shot, do you guys remember?
I kind of like it.
Well,
it was basically
props.
Wiring with some plastic shell on it.
Yeah, it was epoxy. Props, they put some wires and they set it in epoxy. And then they put that grill on the front of it.
The props are the same. Yeah. They didn't make new props until they went to series.
Is that true?
Okay. Yeah. They put a few little doohickeys on the hand laser and called it good. And then they used the exact same communicators.
Never mind.
But they were smart enough to not show it in close-up. They were, you know what I mean?
Oh, you know, here's another thing I was thinking about that actually I was rewatching The Cage with my husband Andy, and we were laughing at some of the things that I don't remember what they were. It might have been the close up shot of the communicator, but there were some really goofy looking moments, and which, you know, are to be expected in a show from the 1960s. But he pointed out that we were watching the remastered versions, and so I'm like, you know what? That might not have looked as bad on a crappy old 1966 television set.
Mm-hmm. Would also look top of the line then.
Good point. Because
that was like top of the line transistors.
Well, sure, but at the same time, like, plastic. It's like a little fuzzier and blurrier. So you know what I mean? Course. It's like when the news channels all switched to HD and all of a sudden all of our anchors' makeup looked terrible. And
yep, I was just thinking of the same thing.
And it goes right, and like, you know, when you watch, like, say the original series, and there's a fight sequence, and it's very obvious now that those are stuntmen. But not when you were watching it on a TV in 1966 or even in 1985.
Yeah, like a 15-inch CRT.
Yeah, you simply didn't see the detail, so it didn't matter.
Yeah, so I just like to throw that in there. We're talking about some of the stuff looking goofy, that we're watching these in a format that was never intended.
Yeah,
right. Context is everything, people.
This is funny. I take it the inverse, which is like, I understand that. I use it in context and enjoy the detail and know that it's like, it is what it is. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Oh, for sure.
I'm fine with that.
For sure. Yeah. But yeah, when you're going to say, oh, they should never have used that close-up, like, maybe it looked fine.
Yeah, I don't know. That believe me, I saw that shot as a kid, and even I was like, damn.
Really?
Yeah. Because it looked like they, like, had no time to build a prop, and were like, ah, shit, we got to put something on there. Here. They would have been better off not showing anything there and just having Pike press a button and have the sound effect.
And that's what's really
on,
funny, is he's in his quarters. There's no need for him to use a communicator. He could have gone up to a wall panel and pressed
a
button.
Yeah.
Maybe, like, you know, Gene was just super excited to introduce this idea of a handheld communicator that he's like, we've got to get it in there.
And that could be.
Yeah, I think they're really jazzed about it. Yeah.
That could be. One other thing I actually liked about The Cage over Where No Man is the bridge.
Oh, explain.
The bridge in The Cage has, like, a little more action in the backgrounds. Like, you know how in
people
the,
get
you
reports.
Know, there's reports flashing on screens. There's, like, monitors, like, showing different information. None of that happens in any of the subsequent episodes. Like, you know, some of it is simply for practical reasons. They couldn't create, I think, new information to put on screens all the time. But it did give the Enterprise bridge more of a feel of a command center where
a little busier.
There's constant information coming in. And, you know, instead of just having a set where, let's face it, it was nothing but blinking lights.
Yeah, Captain Pike is running into yeomen. There's so many people around.
Right. There's a lot of people around. And, like, yeah, and then there's just a, yeah, it's a flurry of activity all the time, and there's things going on everywhere. Yeah. That, there's a little bit less of that once you get into the
That's
series
really true.
For practical reasons. For practical reasons, I understand why it was like that. But it makes that bridge a little more interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right.
Can I bring up the alert klaxon noise?
Okay.
Like, in the cage, it's terrible and, like,
yeah, it's weird.
Inconsistent. It's like, it's literally like they sat a person down on a microphone and were like, go, woo-wee, like,
yeah,
it's not
terrible.
The same tone each time it goes, and it's, like, for different lengths. And so it's, like, and no one seems to be reacting to it. And I was sitting there with my husband, and we're like, is that, like, a red alert? Like, what's going on? And then it gets even more confusing because they, for some reason, decided, all right, guys, you know, we have 90 minutes to tell this story. It's just jam-packed full of stuff. So what we're going to do is we're going to take a solid minute of it. We're going to replay the theme song and show shots of the crew fading on top of space.
Oh, yeah, because they didn't know what to do about warp. Yeah, they didn't know what to do
about warp. Yeah, they had to show warp.
That was supposed to be warp. I had no idea what was
going on. Yes, because they had no idea what...
And why did they put the music over it? It was so
because
weird.
To entertain people.
You have to understand something. The pilot is designed to sell it. So sure. Like that, it's not for those pilots were not necessarily meant for a mass audience. They were meant to be aimed at networking.
Yeah, and then they would once they get sold, they would make a new special effects reel and stuff for. Yeah.
Or just eliminate it altogether. Like right. They may not have even had it in
just,
there at all.
I don't understand the choice to put it in at all. I was completely confused. Like if I was a network executive watching it, and I mean, to be fair, I have no perspective of what they would have been thinking in 1966, but I would be like, what is this? Like why are you playing the theme song again?
I don't think it's a big deal myself.
I don't know. See, I like Brian, I always knew what it was supposed to mean. I was like, oh, they're fading it out because they're like warping. I get it.
Yeah, it's supposed to present interstellar
it was like,
travel.
It was like I thought it was like a montage.
Well, it is, but it's supposed to portray warping. I don't know. It's not good. You're right, but it never threw me either. So I don't know.
No, it never
it completely
bothered me.
Threw me.
Oh, Kayla, you're too spoiled by like good special effects and stuff.
Uh-huh. Just throw in the millennial perspective here, you guys. Like, what is this? Like, what? I can't even with this. I can't. Like, I'm trying to can, and I literally can't.
That was good.
That's scary good, Kayla. Oh, shit. Okay.
OMG.
Alrighty.
But before we do go out on this, I'm sure there's probably more stuff you guys want to say too. But like, I think I'm really interested to hear your guys' thoughts on the tie-in sort of between Cage and Where No Man and TOS and the Discovery premiere. Because Matt sort of started to pick up on that a bit. And, you know, the original reason that we decided to go back and do an episode, a podcast about the pilot episodes is because we get to see a pilot again soon that we've never seen before.
Mm-hmm.
So, well, and the cage is in theory 2 years before Discovery, so we get to see something that's supposed to be roughly contemporary, let's say.
Uh-huh. Oh, interesting.
So in theory it's like 2254 and Discovery is 2256 ish.
Wait, the cage is 2254?
Like 2 years prior. Yeah, it's 2 years prior.
Oh my gosh. Okay.
So Spock and Pike are out there like right now,
right.
You know, doing stuff at in the Discovery time. So 2 years prior, they had their whole just terrible Talosian incident, and they've moved on from that. Whatever they're doing now, yeah. So on that note, that means Talos IV is a forbidden planet, and they could totally make that a throwaway line somewhere in Discovery. You know what I mean? Like
that'd be cute
because that was it'd be fun. There you go, Star Trek Writers' Room. anyway, I don't know if anyone else has stuff to talk about and how it sort of is interesting. But
so I think something they might do is, because since Discovery is going to be a two-parter, is one part will be the more intellectual one and the other part will be the more action-y one. So they can do both of these, right?
Oh, I like it. I don't know if they'll do that. But I like that.
Yeah. Good point. Let's hope they do. Yeah.
That way they get to please both types of storytelling.
I mean, you're right. And in theory, that's exactly why they keep calling themselves a premium show that's on, you know, not on normal network TV, well, for the most part. And, you know, all that kind of stuff is they're supposed to be able to do what they feel like. You know what I mean? They're supposed to be able to have more leeway. And they can do a little bit of the cage stuff that was rejected by, you know, the network peeps back in the 60s. But today they could do that because it would go direct to streaming and someone would pick it up, you know?
And there's a built-in fan base, which, of course, they didn't have originally.
No, right. That's very true.
There were no Star Trek fans in 1965.
That's right. And that's a good point. It's like these two shows, like, in a way, they're almost an easy sell for us now, the two pilots. Because they're two pilots to a franchise that we all know and love. But yeah, think about what a tough sell this was in 64 and then 65 when they got a second chance at it.
Yeah. There was nothing ever like it before on television.
No.
Mm-hmm. And that's why you have to go back to that whole Gene kept saying, oh, well, it's like this other thing. Because you can't...
Sure, yeah.
You can't be like, oh, it's like Star Trek, because that's not a frame of reference yet. So he has to keep saying, yeah, you know these Westerns that are, like, really hot right now? Picture that, but, you know, in space. I mean, really, that's what he's saying.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
And I think that's where to go back to Where No Man Has Gone Before and why that probably sold it, is that's what you get with Where No Man Has Gone Before. You get a kind of dashing... charging the ahead leading man who definitely knows who he is. Like, Shatner came into the role knowing who Kirk was, you know, who takes charge, and he's on the edge of the galaxy, like, literally in this episode.
Yeah.
And that's very much the whole, it's very much along the lines of the Western with the lone hero who's on the outskirts of current territory or something, you know. It all has this feel that makes people... Like, I'm sure this is the reason why, is it made the network people feel comfortable with it, right? Better. They've seen this kind of pattern, these themes before. Whereas The Cage is pretty freaky. It's pretty alien. Like, it's this whole, like, whoa, they went out way in the middle of nowhere, found a wrecked, you know, ship, and then there's these crazy aliens who were messing with minds. Like, that's not exactly accessible to the average network exec who's thinking, this is going to be like a Western. Mm. There will be fisticuffs.
I guess the way you sell it to the network is completely different too. So there's the way you sell it to the audience and the way you sell it to the network. And now you sell it to the network by saying, Trekkies, there are a lot of them and they spend money.
That's right.
So we can make this show.
It's a whole different
thing. And back then you had to convince them that people would buy this stuff. Now that's a given. So now the harder job they have, I guess, is convincing the audience to stick around. If I were them, I might do a more action packed episode one on broadcast television that gets people excited, and then once they're sucked in, hit them with the cerebral stuff and be like, haha, just kidding, this is a cerebral show. We tricked you. But now you like it too much, you have to keep watching.
Well, I hope that's what happens.
Yeah. Let's hope so.
I do not want to watch 15 hours of War Trek.
No.
Yeah.
And from what little things we hear, there's hope that that's not the case. So let's hope that's true.
Yeah. But we're also told that it's going to be a deadly, darker, edgier, hairy mud, right? So.
Yes. And that's kind of a funny, weird thing to say. Like, I mean, I think it's a hairy mud being deadly, like, by a mistake.
But right?
Yeah. Yeah. Harry was more lecherous than anything.
Anyway,
we got off topic there.
To put a button on The Cage and, like, Discovery, I think one of my words I was thinking about The Cage is, you might say it's a fairly gritty world, and man, do Discovery people love to say that their show is gritty.
Don't they?
I think it's kind of a funny, but I think it's a kind of a funny dovetail, because really when you think about it, The Cage is a bit grittier. It is. Pike is a grittier person. And so I think you can see this kind of, I don't know what you want to call it, but maybe gritty commonality. Ugh, that sounds terribly buzzwordy, but there you go. A gritty commonality between the two, at least from what we can see of Discovery. And that's not a bad thing necessarily, you know, it just is. And I think that's speaks to the fact that we all still like The Cage a lot. Like, sure, it's gritty. And a lot of people are like, well, that's not Trek. You know, oh, it's too gritty or something. Well, excuse me. Now I've muddled myself up. A lot of people are leveling that Discovery is maybe too gritty to be the Trek that they like. But it's really interesting because when you look at the, what we all just said here, we actually really like The Cage, like, a lot. So perhaps there's room for grit. Perhaps.
Interesting. I don't find The Cage gritty at all, but...
You don't think so? He's a pretty... Pike is a pretty intense, like, kind of gritty person.
I can see the gritty...
I don't know if I guess it depends what your definition of grit is.
Yeah.
Well, that thing's thrown around way too loosely. I will say that. So, mm-hmm.
I can see the parallel of him being more of a flawed guy. And, you know, we're hearing about having flawed characters in Discovery. Michael Burnham being one of them. Michael Burnham has this fall from grace. And then so there's going to be a character arc for her, presumably in the first two episodes, similar to the one for Pike. Where, I mean, not necessarily that she becomes disenchanted and then comes back, but there will be some kind of a big character arc, you know, where her character goes through a lot of changes and learns a lot of things. And that happened to Pike as well. And then, of course, mm-hmm. we have the captain of the Discovery. What is it that you call him, Jared? Captain Malfoy?
Yeah.
Captain Lucius Malfoy saying that his character is a messed up guy.
Mm-hmm.
So he's gonna be, you know, that's I can see how you would call that gritty.
Okay, well, I have a question for all of you.
Sure.
Given the proximity of The Cage to Discovery, do we think at any time during this show's run will we see Captain Pike and the Starship Enterprise?
Oh yeah, I think at some point they can't resist it. I don't know when, but I think at some point they won't be able to resist.
It's going to be a hell of a tricky thing to do.
I don't think they'll do it the first year.
I agree.
No, definitely. I don't think so either.
I think they'll do it
season three.
Either the last episode of of Discovery. They'll use it as like a torch passing. Like, oh, by the way, like, remember how this was set 10 years before TOS and there the Enterprise exists? Remember that? So, like, this is tied into the timeline now, and they'll show the Enterprise in the last scene. Or they'll use it as like season ender cliffhanger thing, like,
yeah,
oh, there's a ship coming out of this nebula. Wait, the Enterprise cut to black.
Totally.
You know what I mean? Like, I think that if they're going to use it, they'll use it like in one of those ways.
So this is a sort of springboard question from that, then, is what is it going to look like, though? Because they are following a different aesthetic for the ships.
Yeah.
Specifically, they really like these like rectangular nacelles. I don't know why, but there you go. And I don't mean like the refit kind. I mean, they're kind of funky, pointed, and that, you know, at the end.
Yeah.
So, I mean,
yeah,
it would
be interesting to see. That's why I think it might be tricky.
Nacelles? Yeah.
Yeah. That's why I think the whole thing is kind of tricky. But...
It is, and I'm sure they'll stay away from it for a really long time. But then eventually, I think the itch will get to them, you know?
We shall see.
And that is a good segue to remind everyone that for the next several weeks, the Shuttlepod is going to be bringing you recaps and thoughts and news and views having to do with Star Trek Discovery. Each episode of Star Trek Discovery will be followed by Shuttlepod podcast dedicated to talking about that episode. So this is the last traditional episode of the Shuttlepod until Discovery goes on hiatus in November. So this sort of wraps it up for this season of the Shuttlepod, and we're going to segue next time into our very first episode talking about Star Trek Discovery, which will be our premiere episode, episodes 1 and 2 of Star Trek Discovery, a recap of those, our thoughts. There's going to be so much to talk about with this brand new show, so there's going to be a ton of material. We will do our best to fit it into an hour discussion for you guys. That's going to be hard, but it's going to be fun. We can't wait. And I think that's it. Just be sure to tune in. This is the place to get all of your Star Trek Discovery news and views. Here, right here on the Shuttlepod podcast. So that's it for me. I'll see you guys next time.
Bye, everybody. Farewell.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.